Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 23rd, 2001. In the fireside room is Bob Eggblad. Today's session number is EKB 2001-04, and it's titled God's Call Through Prostitutes and Sinners. Let's listen in.
Why don't we begin? Today I want to look at a story that some of you may be familiar with. I'm hoping that people are somewhat familiar with Genesis. How many of you have read the book of Genesis? Okay, well that helps. But for those of you who are less familiar, I'm going to be telling the story of Judah, and we'll be reading some sections as well. And one of my interests today is to look at, and for all of us to kind of discover together, hopefully, how it is that God calls in more covert ways. You know, there's are more hidden ways. I think many people tend to make a distinction between kind of the called and themselves. You know, we make a distinction. We assume that there are certain calls that are far more valuable and important, like calls to ordained ministry or calls to being a teacher or calls to, within the churches, there's a lot of talk about the priesthood of all believers, but the way our churches actually function, I think we elevate the professional call in a way that is destructive. And if we look at the scriptures, we see that there are many ways that people receive calls, and many unexpected people are sort of included in the call. And that should be an empowering word to all of us. The folks who I minister with are people who feel like there's no way that they would be called. And some of them are looking for a call, and they're expecting a call, like a road to Emmaus kind of call, and that doesn't happen. And so they are, they're disappointed, and they say, "Look, I've been wanting God to show up, but I don't see God that is present with me at all." And that's in many ways as a result of the teaching of the church, which is focused too much on models of conversion that are just very limited models. The model of conversion that we have and of call in the New Testament, anyway, come from two scriptures: the call of Nicodemus, when Jesus says you must be born again, and the call of the Apostle Paul. And the thing that we don't pay attention to is that these are both calls of Pharisees. Okay, they're not calls of the marginalized, right? And so when we try to, unless we are sort of most associated with the Pharisee, these texts, really are less relevant to us. The calls of sinners and of the common and the ordinary and the broken and the normal humans, I think we need to look elsewhere in the scriptures. And the story that we're going to look at today is one of those elsewheres. So what I want to do is focus on a text that is sort of confused a lot of scholars. And it's the story of Judah and Tamar. Judah and Tamar's story happens in chapter 38 of Genesis, and it's sort of an interruption, not sort of, it is an interruption to the Joseph cycle. The Joseph cycle begins, earlier in Genesis, like 36, I think, somewhere, where Joseph is has all of his dreams, and Joseph, if we remember the story of the patriarchs, we have we have Abraham and Sarah, and God chooses in a way to go through this child of the promise. Instead of the firstborn being chosen, Isaac, the secondborn, who is actually Abraham's secondborn, but Sarah's firstborn, ends up being the one through whom the promise goes. And then Isaac hooks up with Rebekah, and as we saw yesterday, those of you who were here, the two, the oldest and the youngest, Isaac chooses the firstborn, even though he was the secondborn. Isaac chooses power rather than weakness. And this is a tendency that we see throughout the patriarchal narratives, you know, throughout all the stories of Genesis, is that the elect, who are elected by grace, often make choices on behalf of those who seem to merit the most, you know, the powerful. And I think there's a refusal, a rejection of weakness that is just a normal human, part of the human condition that we see operating here. You know, the tendency for the elect to always prefer those that measure up and those who are more attractive, those who are more beautiful. You know, and so we choose the saved who are saved by grace, end up choosing the saved who are saved by merit, and folks are excluded. And so we find ourselves at odds with God's plan and project, so God ends up having to work in a roundabout way from the, you know, around the margins and around the edges of the story. And fortunately, the biblical writers were inspired enough to include a lot of stories in the scriptures that articulate this, and that really, to me, appear to be the dominant voice within the scriptures, although often, you know, they don't appear to be dominant. I mean, we have to kind of discover that, I guess, which is what we're going to try to do today. So anyway, Isaac chooses Esau, but, you know, it's Jacob, the weak one, the scoundrel, the criminal, the smooth tent dweller, you know, and heel grabber, who ends up being the one. Okay, well, what about Jacob then? Did Jacob learn his lesson being chosen by grace? No. You know, Jacob, first thing he does is he chooses the most beautiful of the daughters, Rachel, and who does happen to be the second born, you know, but that doesn't appear to be the reason he chose her. And Jacob chooses Rachel, and Leah, who's the one who is less attractive, ends up being put into his bed in place of Rachel by Laban, who says, hey, in our culture, we give the firstborn first, not the secondborn, which is sort of a twist on Jacob's, a reminder of Jacob's whole, you know, his criminal sort of background. So anyway, Rachel ends up not being able to have any kids. And meanwhile, Leah, the one who's not so beautiful, ends up just being very, very productive and has, you know, bang, 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 you know, three in a row. And then the fourth one, Judah, is born. And then the womb is closed and God remembers Rachel. And Rachel has a child, and that child is Joseph. Okay? And anyway, Joseph becomes the preferred one of the father, who probably saw Rachel as the true, you know, legitimate mother of his heir. You know, remember the genealogies. There's many, many genealogies in Genesis, and genealogies show us that God, that the people are seeing the lineage going all the way back to Adam and, you know, Abraham, through the firstborn son of the firstborn son of the firstborn son of the firstborn son. Okay? And so anyway, here we have Joseph, who seems to be the father's choice one. And but being chosen and being the one who has all the attention, being the beautiful one and the privileged one, has many disadvantages. You know, being the saved in the scriptures isn't necessarily an advantage. You know, being the righteous or the one who's the preferred has great disadvantages. And so what we see in the story of Joseph, I'll just give you a little summary of the story up to the point of the Judah-Tamar story, is that Joseph is given this special coat by his father and all this attention and love. And whereas the other brothers are just sort of not even regarded. And so the 10 brothers are out in the fields, and, you know, taking care of the sheep, and one day Joseph is sent. And by the way, before this, Joseph has had these dreams, right? These dreams of his sheaves, of wheat bowing down to him, and of his brothers all bowing down to him. And he tells these dreams to his brothers. So there's this growing tension between the elect and the rejected, you know, this jealousy, this rivalry. that is just tearing, is torn apart this family, this Jacob's family. And all because of this kind of this tendency to choose, you know, for the chosen one to choose, you know, the beautiful and the insider or whatever. And so anyway, finally this culminates in this story where Joseph is sent out to find his brothers. And he goes out and they see him coming and they said, here is the, you know, the, here comes Joseph the dreamer. Let's kill him, right? And anyway, Reuben says, no, let's throw him in this pit, okay? And Reuben's plan is to go, Reuben's the firstborn, Reuben's plan is to sneak back to the pit and pull his brother out and bring him back to his father. But he doesn't act in time because Judah, number four, who apparently has no importance because he's number four, Judah steps up and says, no, let's not shed any blood. Let's sell him to the Midianites. So anyway, Judah ends up, his brothers go for the idea. I mean, we can make money out of this deal and you know, we won't be killing him. And so they sell him as a slave into Egypt. Okay, end of scene one and the beginning of this story of Judah and Tamar. Okay, and Judah and Tamar's story is just this kind of a break in the whole story. It begins in chapter 38, verse 1, and ends at the end of that chapter. And in 39:1, we have the scene of Joseph in Potiphar's house. You know, he's sold, he is bought by one of the officials in Egypt, Potiphar. And then we have the story, which I'll continue in a few minutes. But I want to just plant the beginnings of this story in your minds by reading the very first few lines of Judah, of this Judah-Tamar episode. Now, Judah-Tamar episode begins 38, verse 1. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and settled near a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He married her, he went into her. She conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Again she conceived and bore a son, whom she named Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she named him Shelah. She was in Chezib when she was born. Okay, so, and then and the story goes on. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her. Raise up offspring for your brother. But since Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, he spilled his semen on the ground whenever he went into his brother's wife so that he would not give offspring to his brother. What he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, for he feared that he too would die like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. Okay, this is just a bizarre sort of a beginning of a story, which we're going to read the rest of a little bit later. But scholars have just been baffled. I mean, why this kind of a diversion away from the story of Joseph? You know, this elect one, this beautiful one with his coat has been taken, but now he's saved and here he's gone and he's been given this special, I mean, he's a servant in the house of this Potiphar, but we watch him just get elevated because the Lord is with him, right? He becomes the head of the household. And then Potiphar's husband, or Potiphar's wife, is very attracted by him and tries to get him to sleep with her. And he refuses because he's so righteous, right? And actually the narrative there is quite fascinating to study in detail, to look at how Joseph plays with his beauty and his giftedness and his power and how he uses it. And what we see is that there's the tremendous kind of risks involved in being the elect or being, you know, being the preferred, you know, but before humans, right? Anyway, those risks end up landing him once again in a pit. You know, he's accused of rape. and he's sent into the prison where he spends many years. And there in the prison, he begins to tell the dreams of some of the like the cupbearer and the baker of the Pharaoh, right? But they forget about him. One of them gets killed, the other gets released, and the cupbearer forgets about Joseph until the Pharaoh has a crisis. He's got a dream, this incredible dream, and nobody can answer it until finally the cupbearer remembers Joseph, and Joseph's brought up. Joseph tells him the dream, and you remember the dream is that there will be 7 years of plenty, or it's interpreted that the dream means that there'll be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. And then Joseph recommends that during the 7 years of plenty, that somebody be appointed to store all this grain, right, in preparation for the 7 years of famine. And so that somebody ends up being Joseph. And Joseph is elevated, and he becomes like second under Pharaoh. And at that point, the famine comes after he's already stored all the grain. And then we have Jacob and his and all of Joseph's brothers, Jacob and all of his sons. They're experiencing the famine. And they come as a delegation, you know, all the brothers except Benjamin, right? They all come to Egypt to get grain, and there they end up coming before Joseph. Joseph recognizes them, and there's some things that happened that I want to focus on now, and the things that happen have to do with Judah, okay? So what I want us to do is look at Judah sort of before, which we've just done. You know, Judah, this person who is a schemer. I mean, he sells his brother instead of killing him. You know, makes some money off the deal, and then goes away with less of a guilty conscience. And you know, and anyway, so, but he's guilty of having sold his own brother, and then he ends up going off with a Canaanite woman and having these sons that are all dying. I mean, there's nothing very hopeful about Judah at all. Nothing noteworthy or noble. And then suddenly we see Judah, you know, later in Egypt, you know, with his brothers, and the story continues. Judah and is with his brothers, and they come before Joseph. Joseph just doesn't he recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. Joseph says, you know, listen, I'd like, do you have any other brothers? And he explores and finds out that Benjamin, this prized, fine, you know, youngest son of the favorite wife, is back at home. And so he insists that they bring, to prove that they're not lying, that they go and they get the youngest son and they bring him back, right? And so, and they hold Simeon, who is like the second born, as a hostage, Joseph does, until the brothers come back with Benjamin. Okay, so the brothers, they all go back to their father, and I'd like us to read a section of what happens to show you something about Judah that appears to have changed. Let's look at Genesis 43, verses 3 and following. And I'll just read this. But Judah said to him, the man solemnly warned us. Oh, actually, before this section, in verses 1 and 2, see, Jacob does not want Benjamin to go. There's no way that this son is going. I've already lost my favorite son, and now this one, there's no chance. Okay, and then Reuben steps up, the firstborn, who has shown himself to be a terrible failure at getting anywhere, right? Or doing anything successful. He once again demonstrates his inability by coming forward and saying, look, I will, if it doesn't work out, if Benjamin doesn't come back, you can kill my two sons. You know, great idea. You know, the firstborn offers to kill his firstborn and the secondborn as a solution, right? Well, the father says, you know, no, that's not going to do it. And then Judah comes in, that's verse 3. But Judah said to him, the man solemnly warned us, saying, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you will send your brother with us, if you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. Israel said, why did you treat me so badly as to tell the man that you had another brother? They replied, the man questioned us carefully about ourselves and our kindred, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? What we told him was an answer to these questions. Could we in any way know what he would say? Bring your brother down? Then Judah said to his father Israel, send the boy with me, and let us be on our way, so that we may live and not die, you and we and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him, or I myself will be a guarantee or a ransom for him. You can hold me accountable to him, or for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. Okay. This attitude of Judah, it doesn't seem like we're dealing with the same Judah as we were dealing with in the beginning of the story, does it? It appears that there's some sort of a change in Judah. And this change is confirmed by the following story. You know, they all Jacob agrees and lets Benjamin go. They go down to Egypt. Joseph interviews them all and then sends them all back with grain. But he does something. You know, he sets up a trap. He puts his own silver cup in the grain bag of Benjamin, you know, Jacob's favorite son, without them knowing it. And then he sends them all off with a blessing, and they all go off. Then he sends his officers in pursuit of them. And they say, what have you done? You know, Joseph has been so generous to you, and you've taken his silver cup. And they say, oh, we haven't done that. And, you know, and they say, okay, well, let's search your bags. And they search the bags, and they find the silver cup in the top of the bag of Benjamin. And so they're all put under arrest and brought before Joseph. And here we come to the section of text, chapter 44, verse 14, which I'd like to read, 14 and following. Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house while he was still there, and they fell to the ground before him. Joseph said to them, what deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that one such as I can practice divination? And Judah said, what can we say to my lord? What can we speak? How can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Here we are then, my lord's slaves, both we and also the one in whose possession the cup has been found. But he said, far be it from me that I should do so. Only the one in whose possession the cup was found shall be my slave. But as for you, go in peace to your father. You see, this is just torturous. Yeah. You know, Joseph is just a torturer. And is totally using his power position to his advantage, right? Just this heavy-duty revenge going on. And Judah stepped up to him and said, oh, my lord, let your servant please speak a word in my lord's ears, and do not be angry with your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My lord asked his servant, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my lord, we have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead. He alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me so that I may set eyes on him. We said to my lord, the boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. Then you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my lord. And when our father said, go again, buy us a little food, we said, we cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother goes with us will we go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. My wife, not my wives, bore me 12 sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I have never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm comes to him, you will bring down my gray hairs and sorrow to Sheol. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, when he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant, Judah, and Judah speaking of himself now, became surety, or became a ransom, for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I will bear the blame in the sight of my father all my life. Now therefore, please let your servant remain as a slave to my lord in the place of the boy. And let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the suffering that would come upon my father. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, send everyone away from me. So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Okay, so Judah is reflecting a consistent change here. You know, Judah is exemplary, and it's Judah's graciousness and willingness to give, to die and give himself, that brings about the conversion of Judah of Joseph, right? It's amazing. And what is it that triggered this call? I mean, when is there any place in the story of Genesis that shows any kind of call where Judah might have been called by his name in any way? I'd like to, with that question in mind, I'd like us to read this Judah and the Tamar story, because this is a story that, you know, we haven't looked at yet, which is right in between, you know, these different stories. Okay, so we know that we're going to start 38, verse 12. And could I ask one of you to read this loudly and clearly? Now remember, Tamar has been sent away to her father's house. You know, we have this story of Judah with Shua, the Canaanite woman. Her son, Judah takes Tamar for a wife for him. Okay, he dies. Because he's evil, the Lord puts him to death, which is a question we're not going to get into today. Okay, then Tamar is given to Onan. Then Onan is evil because he refuses to pass on the seed. And so this lineage can't continue. And so anyway, he dies. And then the third son, Shelah, who's not there, is not given to Tamar. You know, because Judah is thinking, okay, well, he's going to die too, because this must have to do with Tamar in some way. Okay, so Tamar is sent away, and now we have the next episode of the story. Verse 12 and following.
In course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah's time of mourning was over, he went up to Timnah, to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to shear his sheep, she put off her widow's garments, put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down at the entrance to Enam, which is on the road to Timnah. She saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He went over to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He answered, I will send you a kid from the flock. And she said, only if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and the staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Then she got up and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood.
Keep going.
When Judah sent the kid by his friend, the Adullamite, to recover the pledge from the woman, he could not find her. He asked the townspeople, where is the temple prostitute who was at Enam by the wayside? But they said, no prostitute has been here. So he returned to Judah and said, I have not found her. Moreover, the townspeople said, no prostitute has been here. Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own. Otherwise, we will be laughed at. You see, I sent this kid, and you could not find her. About 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the whore. Moreover, she is pregnant as a result of whoredom. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, it was the owner of these who made me pregnant. And she said, take note, please, whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Then Judah acknowledged them and said, she is more in the right than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah, and he did not lie with her again. When the time of her delivery came, there were twins in her womb. While she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took it and bound on his hand a crimson thread, saying, this one came out first. But just then he drew back his hand, and out came his brother, and she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore, he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out with the crimson thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah.
All right. So, what do you make of this? I mean, what is there any, what happens in this story that could be decisive? Is this sort of reflects the hinge or the center, where we have a change from Judah, the old Judah and the new Judah. What is it that happens here? What do you make of this? How do you interpret this story?
He decided he was more in the wrong than the daughter-in-law at that point. Yeah.
Okay. So his confession of guilt, would you call that his call? Any other ideas?
He acknowledged he denied her his son.
Okay. What did he do in order to accomplish, the larger project here? I mean, there's a larger project. Judah has a problem. He doesn't have a descendant, right? Mm-hmm. And
I thought he had a son that was still alive.
He had one son who was still alive, but he didn't have a son of that son. He needed to have.
I see what you're saying.
He needed to have a firstborn. You know, he needed to have a son who would be a grandson or whatever in order to pass the lineage down. And he doesn't have that yet, right? Mm-hmm. Now Judah is a typical male of his time. He's an actor, you know, and the subject of his history. A narrative read of this story, I think, is really helpful, and. This is an approach that I think is underused in our churches, and most of us could benefit from just learning how to read, looking at who the characters are and their actions, and just some basic reading strategies. A lot of the historical critical focus, I think, has taken the Bible away from the people in a way, making us feel like, hey, the Bible is just too, we don't have all this background, we're not experts, we can't really know anything. But with the folks that I work with who are never going to have access to, to historical critical sort of, huge libraries or the internet or anything, many of them are illiterate or semi-literate, but just the scriptures are all they have. And sometimes all they have, just hearing the scriptures is all they can only benefit from hearing the scriptures because they can't read. But narrative reading is something that is possible for anybody. What I'd like to do is go through quickly and look at Judah, okay, as a major character here, and his actions. Okay, he's the subject of many verbs. He's the primary actor. If we go through really quick, beginning in verse 38 or chapter 38, verse 1, What are some of the verbs where Judah is?
Went down.
Went down? Okay.
Saw.
I think we have settled before that, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay. Then we have saw. Okay. Then
married.
What?
Married.
Married.
Went.
Went in.
Went into? Okay.
Name.
I think we have took before that, don't we? He took a wife. I mean, he took Tamar, right? Mm-hmm. And he, as a wife for his son. Okay. And then what do we have?
You're skipping.
Oh yeah, you're right. Went in her, she conceived. Okay, boy, and name, you're right. Went into. I'm sorry. After that, then we have took.
Took.
So now we're at verse 6. And then it's just set, okay? I think. Okay, at this point, if we look at Tamar in contrast, where is she in the story? What position does she have up to this point? Is she a subject of her own life, of her own story? She enters in right here, I believe, doesn't she? Okay. So she's taken, right?
Right.
So she's taken as wife, and then what else? He says to her, right? I mean, that's coming at the Onan. And then later, verse further on, then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. Mm-hmm. For he feared that he too would die like his brother. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. Okay? So basically he banishes her. Okay? She's told to remain a widow, and so she's, at this point, she's completely powerless. Okay, then what happens? If we look at verse 12, then it says, in the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah's time of mourning was over, okay, once again, we have Judah the actor. So anyway, Judah's wife, Shua, dies. So Judah went up. You know, first of all, he goes down, and now he's going up. He and his friend, and when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. Now let's look at this is suddenly there's a change in Tamar, and Tamar becomes the subject of a number of verbs. What are the verbs Tamar is the subject of?
She put on.
Put off.
Okay.
And put on.
Put off. Put on.
Wrapped.
Sat down.
Saw. It's interesting. Suddenly, there's a complete shift in terms of power. I mean, in terms of actions. The whole focus of the story, shifts to Tamar, and we have, even some repetitions of the same verbs. She saw, he saw. So Tamar is suddenly becoming a subject of her own history. What else after this? So she put off, she put on, she wrapped herself, she sat down, and then she saw.
She said.
Okay, and then we have Judah once again. So what happens with Judah here?
He saw.
Okay, so Judah saw.
He saw.
He thought.
And he thought.
He said.
And then he said.
He went over.
Okay, come, let me come in to you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And then suddenly she said, okay, and we have a back and forth here, you know, that is quite interesting. And she said, only if you give me a pledge until you send it. No, wait. She said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? And he answered. And see, now he's in a relationship. It's shifting, right? He's answering to her rather than her just answering to him. Okay, he answered, I will send you a kid from the flock. And she said, only if you give me a pledge until you send it. And he said, what pledge shall I give you? And she replied, your signet and your cord and the staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her. Okay. So anyway, he gave. And we can keep going with this. But then what happens?
She became pregnant.
Okay. He went into her and she conceived. Okay, let's keep going with this. And then keep going. What else happens to her?
She got up and went away.
Got up.
And went.
Went away.
Takes off.
Okay. Took off.
Put on.
Put on. Okay. Now, if you did a structural analysis of this particular story, you'd see that put on and put off, you know, sort of are like two bookends, right? Mm-hmm. And what would be right at the heart of this story? I mean, you know, put off, put on, wrapped, took off, sat down, got up. Okay. What's right at the heart of the story?
Conceived,
exactly. He went into her and she conceived. Okay.
Bingo.
What is it that brings about this transformation, this change of status? Is there any? What do you make of this?
Tamar was desperate. She had no status.
She had absolutely no status.
She didn't have a husband, she didn't have a son.
Right.
She was living with her father.
Mm-hmm.
She took matters into her own hands.
Okay. Yeah. Is there any sign of this being a call in any way in this story? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the really interesting things in the book of Genesis is you have all these actions that later are shown to be part of this thread of God's action throughout the story of Genesis, right? And you know, people may not know in the moment that they're acting as part of God's project of liberation, project of life. But later they're able to see that we're able to see, and we will see that actually this reflects, I mean, this brings about a decisive change. This, you know, when Tamar becomes a subject of her own story, suddenly, you know, Judah, I mean, this leads to a complete shift in the whole rest of the story of Genesis, okay? Because Judah, what happens to Judah as a result of this, of Tamar becoming a subject?
He becomes humble.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so he becomes, in a way, a passive. I mean, he unwittingly enters into this project of salvation in a passive way. I mean, he's active, but he ignorant in a way that reflects total ignorance. He falls into this situation that ends up leading to, you know, a lineage for himself. I mean, a descendants for himself, and all of it is done, through Tamar. So if we were to look at a decisive moment that could be called a call for Judah, what would you say it would be? When did the call begin for Judah?
When he realized his mistake.
Do you think so?
I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, it could be, but what was his mistake, and was it a mistake?
Sold his brother.
Okay, it could be right at that moment when he sold his brother, because later Joseph says, look, you meant it for evil, but God has used it for good. Right? Because look, because I'm down in Egypt, I have been brought up into this position of authority where I've been able to feed all of you, and that's preserved life, right? So without you even knowing it, you know, because of your natural human reaction to, you know, to me being the preferred and me flaunting it, you know, you brought about life for all the people, right? You know, it's one thing you see in Genesis is that God is at work right in the dirtiest, sort of messiest, bloodiest, ugliest situations. I mean, you know, God is at work as calling, but in a way that is completely surprising, I mean, and unexpected, and non-kosher, and unethical.
It kind of goes against the idea of God has a blueprint for your life.
Yeah. Well, if there is a blueprint, it's incredibly a liberating blueprint, because it could be almost anything. Right? So could we say that Judah's seeing in this story, actually, and Judah's seeing and thinking in response to Tamar's acting as a subject of her own life, it's really through this ruse and through this attraction to a prostitute that the whole story shifts. I mean, could we say that Judah's choice to go into a prostitute is really his a decisive moment of call? Is that possible?
Wouldn't be Orthodox Methodist theology.
I know some ministers that thought they had the call and got in big trouble.
Now you can just imagine this story read among a group of marginal women who are all oppressed by their husbands and who don't have a voice or a vote, you know, say in a poor Central American village or in one of our communities. I mean, groups of marginal women exist everywhere. How does this story strike you? I mean, how would people react to this story? How do you think this could be heard by the folks?
It would seem that Tamar only became empowered when she decided to become a prostitute. That's the only time she has legitimacy to be able to enact this transaction.
Yeah. Okay. So in a way, to go against and that prostitute, that act was tremendously risky. I mean, look what it led to. As soon as she's conceived, she's denounced, and her father-in-law says, "Bring her out. We're going to burn her." I mean, you know, this was this could this be seen as an act of faith, you know, to be a prostitute?
I don't think she became a prostitute. I think she knew exactly what she was doing. She knew who was walking down that road, and she knew who she was tricking. And the minute she got what she went there for, she totally disappeared and became the widow.
So maybe it's not Tamar who actually becomes a prostitute, but, you know, but it's Judah. Who goes into a prostitute? Who goes into what he thinks is a prostitute?
What he saw. Sure. And Tamara, as far as I'm concerned, knew exactly what she was doing, and that she set out to conceive Judah's child.
Okay.
And she not only conceived one, she conceived two.
Yeah.
And then by that, Judah was then forced to look at what he did and what his original intentions were, which was to go into a prostitute.
Yes, exactly.
But had it been a real prostitute, I mean, just a different prostitute, and the same thing would have happened, would the story have been different?
Sure, well, I think so.
I don't know. But one thing someone
noted. It still would have been his children.
Yeah. Someone pointed out in the last session that Tamar also refuses payment. You know, she does not accept the kid,
yeah,
right, and ends up giving back the signet ring.
That's because she wanted to have those articles to later prove who had conceived her children.
Okay.
So that was very thought out.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, prostitution is accepting a gift in return for, or there's an exchange for sex. And so by not accepting it, she denies her role as a prostitute.
That's right. That's
he offers it. So he plays the role, but she denies that.
Yeah, although she does benefit too because she receives an offspring as a result of the exchange.
Yeah, it's
yeah, but she also is able to save her own life.
She's able to save her own life, yeah, as a result. But as a result of Judah's, in a way, I mean, at that point, see, that Judah could have been in total denial and decided to just stone her anyway. But see, that maybe that's where there's a certain integrity or you know, a choice or whatever to be made. Judah, at that point, accepts his own culpability and is humble and confesses, right? You know, rather than saying, "Hey, that's a bunch of BS." You know, we're gonna kill her anyway, and then just get his signet ring back. And I mean, you know, he was totally capable of that. It appears to me.
It wouldn't have been really embarrassing for him to, you know, acknowledge the fact that he slept with her.
I would think so. Yeah, because it points out that he didn't go into her again. You know.
Well, something pretty major appears to have changed his mind that didn't happen before in ways that he would have thought would have gotten his attention, that somehow he was doing things wrong. When God has killed two of his sons, you would have thought there would have been a sort of clue there that something's going wrong with his family. And he doesn't seem to have caught it the first two times.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious that they say here that it's God's hand that has killed these sons, and he hasn't gotten it. So something obviously has happened here that this time he gets it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he wants to protect his third son from who he thinks is probably the perpetrator, who's Tamar, right? Mm-hmm. But in the end, it's Tamar who saves him. Right, because I mean, Tamar's plan is the one that ends up winning all of this action. You know, all of this kind of, you know, what Luther would call active righteousness, or you know, just sort of activism. All of the action leads. What does it lead to? It just leads to, you know, to complete failure. Right, but it's the action of the disempowered one who suddenly, you know, for some reason becomes empowered. You know, in this. A call? I mean, did Tamar, is she responding to a call? Is the scripture inviting us to reflect, to see Tamar's kind of a decision to sort of become a subject of her own history? Are we invited to see that as her call? You know, this bold action of willingness to risk her own security and you know, and her and being killed and everything and burned. Could that be the call? And what do you make of the fact that Judah gives up his, she requests his staff and his signet ring. What is he, in fact, giving up at that point?
His identity.
His identity, okay. Mm-hmm. So at this point, he is giving, he's dying to himself completely, right?
That's something that I guess kind of baffled me, is that he was so willing to give up those things to a prostitute, which is what he thought she was.
Well, it happens all
that
the time.
Very simple.
So,
pretty important things, you know?
Anyway, one of the things that's really fascinating about this story is when you look at Judah in the larger picture of, you know, Judah, Joseph, in a way, ends up being set aside as the highlighted one in the story. You know, it's Joseph ends up going into exile, and for the Jewish community who's reading these stories, often in exile themselves, you know, they're reflecting and thinking, okay, why have we ended up in exile? Well, maybe the reason we've ended up in exile is because of this favoritism, this attempt, this tendency to choose the most beautiful. And to choose the, you know, the firstborn, to choose the macho, the powerful, you know, over and against choosing weakness and kind of recognizing and facing our own weakness, right? And so because we have this tendency, we end up, all this rivalry ends up separating us and causing, you know, us to be broken, busted apart, and we go into exile, right? But yet God is at work even when we do this, right? Because through Joseph, And through all of this bad stuff that's happening in the family, this sibling rivalry that ends up in, you know, Joseph being sold as a slave, God is at work to say, to bring about life, right? And, you know, there's this, it's like God's going to work out God's salvation even though we make the wrong choices left and right. It seems like that's one of the major points in the book of Genesis. You know, even though we don't respond to the call, it's like the call comes over us, you know, in the form of Tamar coming over, you know, winning, kind of seducing, or not seducing, but just trapping her father-in-law. You know, the call happens maybe as a result of entrapment, or as a result. I mean, it's all over our heads, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah, it seems that's really true, and throughout the Old Testament, particularly that idea that you can find you can make lemonade out of the lemons. You know, you can find that God's working through all of these strange things, these very imperfect people. But it seems that like you said about what's his name on. Judah, when you're talking about him, he has to open his eyes, though. I mean, it's like he could have gone into denial. And throughout that all, that's a key piece of that puzzle. You got to be able to see it. You got to want to see it.
Yeah.
Or if you don't, it's all, you're blind.
Although in this story, it's like it's complete exposure, right? It's like, in a way, to deny the truth would have been ludicrous. I mean, for Judah to say, no, I mean, this isn't my signet ring, and this isn't my scepter. You know, what's interesting is if you read the very end of Genesis 49:8, I'll just read you Jacob's blessing of Judah. Okay, when on his deathbed, he says, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you. Here's like a reversal, right? Before it's Joseph, who everyone's going to bow down to, but now Judah seems to have the shift seems to be over onto Judah. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you've gone up. He crouches down. He stretches out like a lion, like a lioness. Who dares rouse him up? And then look at verse 10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. You know, the staff shall not depart. It did depart, and it was in the hands of a woman, you know, who he thought was a prostitute. And it was because it was in the hands of a woman that it's back in his hands, right? That's what's amazing. It's like this disempowered woman who suddenly takes this step of empowerment, being a subject of her history, actually is what shifts everything for Judah and shifts everything in the book of Genesis and continues the story forward. Okay, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him and the obedience of the peoples is his. And of course, you know, this is Judah. It's through Judah that the Messiah comes. And if we look at Genesis, at Matthew chapter 5, chapter 1, in the genealogy of Jesus, you know, there's four women. You know, usually the genealogy is just the firstborn son to the firstborn son. Well, in Jesus' genealogy, check this out. You guys probably already know all this.
But what?
Matthew 1, 2, 1 and 2. An account of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Mm-hmm. And Perez, the father of Hezron, and Hezron, the father of Aram. Okay, and it goes on, and it's all men, men, men. But there are four women. And who are they? Who are these women? The first woman is Tamar, you know. Second woman is Rahab, the prostitute, you know, in Jericho. The third woman is Ruth, who is a Moabitess. Second one is a real prostitute. You know, the third one is a foreigner, a stranger, Ruth. The fourth one is Bathsheba, who David slept with and killed the husband, you know, Uriah, right? And then we're all set up to be introduced to Mary, you know, the mother of Jesus, who was with birth before she was married, right? So, you know, this story and this that this is in the Bible is the best news to the people that I work with, and it should be good news for us as well, you know. I remember a situation of a woman who was who wanted to talk with me as a pastor. She wanted to. She was in the jail, and it's a Filipina woman. And she said, "You know, I have to accept Jesus as my Savior, and I just want to do it right now." And I said, "Oh well, how old are you?" She says, "29." You know, and I said, "Well, tell me, are you new to the church?" And she says, "No, I've grown up Catholic, and I grew up all my life going to Mass." Okay, well, why now? You know. And she says, "Well, because I just can't. It's just going to get worse and worse. You know, God is just—it's just too hard right now. You know, I'm going looking at jail, serious jail time." And I asked her. We talked about her images of God. You know, I said, "Well, how do you view God right now?" And she had a real hard time even talking about that. But eventually, she said, "Well, God is basically this distant sovereign who is really coming down on me hard right now." And, you know, so it became clear to me that I wasn't ready to have her sign on the dotted line and accept Jesus into her heart, because she just saw God as someone who she needed to get off her back, right? And so, anyway, I asked her, I said, "Well, do you see God as this distant force?" And she says, "Well, don't you?" You know, and I said, "Well, I can see why you would never want to come to God if you see God this way." And anyway, she just couldn't. She saw that. She told me. She said, "Look, you know, I've been God could never accept me, you know, because of my behaviors." And I said, "Well, what sorts of behaviors would keep God from loving you?" She said, "Well, like having a child out of wedlock." And so anyway, we talked about that, and I told her I just didn't see that as a barrier at all. And she said, so she started to tell me more. She says, "Well, like being a topless dancer for the last 5 years." Okay, so. Anyway, we read the scripture. I read her the scripture from Romans that says nothing can separate us from God. You know, height nor depth nor angels. Actually, before that, it says there's this section in Romans 8 that says, shall hardship, shall famine, shall nakedness. You know, when I got to that text about nakedness, she just was blown away. You know, nakedness? Nakedness can't separate us from the love of God. You know, and anyway, we read. I read her this story about these women in Jesus' genealogy, and when we, as I was reading it, she just wept. You know, she couldn't believe it that God would work. You know, that God could work through these figures, and you know, and that God would consider them worthy. And you know, this looking at these sort of unknown or lesser known characters in the Bible in these stories is very, very powerful for people on the margins. But also, I think for people like us, to see that God, you know, that God is at work and calling in totally unexpected, unkosher ways.
It seems very liberating to me to hear this story, and I wonder too, in this way, I wonder too what you make of, like in some ways, our efforts to be open to call. Like, if call's going to happen anyway, I mean, I go to this small church where we encourage each other to listen to what our call might be and then act out of it. And it's just kind of curious to me that there's this call happening when people aren't even listening or trying. Do you think it in any way, you know, negates our efforts to be open to that, or?
I think it's more like, I see the scriptures as like a training ground for training us in discernment, you know, to know how it is that God works, the ways in which God works, so that we can identify the ways in which God works in our lives, you know, with fresh eyes, you know. We wouldn't normally think God could work in our lives like God worked in Judah and Tamar's life. So to see that God can work that way opens us to thinking, okay, well, let me look back at my life again. And I think, you know, oftentimes we don't see call until way later. And then we can look back at our lives from a certain perspective and say, wow, you know, God was at work through this and this and this and this and this. And a lot of unexpected ways, you know, that God, that we can see the thread passing through a lot of dark places, right? But I mean, the scriptures, I think, can kind of teach us so that we can be alert to that in advance, maybe. Just one last thing that I want to point out, that, you know, Judah dies in a way to himself and reflects this. And later, Judah's whole way and his attitude are brought up in the Gospels in a really unexpected place that kind of shocked me. In Matthew 20, we have the mother of the sons of Zebedee. You know, she comes up and she says, let my sons be at the right and the left hand when you enter your kingdom, right? They're thinking about Joseph, Joseph's mentality of having the brothers bow down to them and everything. And, you know, the disciples are all riled by that. You know, verse 24, it says, when the 10 heard it, they were angry with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. I mean, think of Joseph, the way he was treating his brothers, right? It will not be so among you, but whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave. So in the Judah-Joseph exchange, you see basically this same dynamic of sons of Zebedee and Jesus, you know, disciples. And then it says, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave, just as the Son of Man came not to be served, like Joseph was being served, but to serve. You know, Judah says, let me be a slave, you know, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So Judah had given his life, right? And it was given, in a way, it was given back to him as a result of his seeing and thinking and going into this prostitute and, you know, giving up his ring and his whole identity. I mean, that death was like his baptism. And that's a really unexpected. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see someone preach on that for a baptism service. So anyway, I'm hoping that these stories, you know, can shake up our categories a bit and open us to maybe learning to see the call and to identify the call in some new ways. Tomorrow we're going to look at the call of God's call to Pharaoh, you know, which is usually we don't think of Pharaoh being a beneficiary of any call or God having any kind of being in pursuit of Pharaoh. But, you know, Pharaoh as the ultimate kind of dominant culture, you know, dominant empire, you know, sort of chief. You know, is there a call that can be discerned in the Exodus story on Pharaoh's life? So that'll be our final session. I want to let you know that we have, you know, we're starting a whole new training program in our ministry over in Skagit County. It's called the People Seminary, and where we're offering courses to congregations in doing scripture study with people on the margins. And so if anyone has any interest in that, we have a website that's just getting off the ground, and you can take one of these and drop them up for you.